Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, April Fool's Day, and Easter Sunday, 2018. This is episode 1476. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Flexible and entertaining training for your IT career. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by LastPass. Join the over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Happy Easter. Happy April Fool's Day. This is the show where we talk about tech, Easter eggs, and April Fool's. 888-ASK-LEO. That's the number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Yeah, the show's live. I'm here today, and I hope you'll join me with your calls and questions. It should be a good day to get in, usually on holidays. There are not as many people trying to get in. Busy people doing Easter egg hunts and church and stuff. So this would be a good time to call 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. We talk about, anything with a chip in it, anything having to do with computers, technology, the internet, programming, computer programming. Yeah, we sometimes talk about that. Internet technology stuff, home theater, which are sure, big screen TVs, talk about that. Smartphones, of course, the computer that you use more than any other, probably. Smart watches, the computer you use less than any other, probably. Augmented reality, virtual reality. I saw, speaking of virtual reality, the geek movie of the year. Well, at least until Star Wars comes out. That's Ready Player One, just came out this weekend. Steven Spielberg did it, and it's fun because fun for a lot of 80s nostalgia buffs. People who grew up in the 80s will enjoy all the references, and it's chock-a-block with them. But fun also because it's about a near future where, I think 2045, something like that, 20 years from now, when virtual reality is so commonplace that everybody does it, at least some a little bit a day during the day. And it's a fun envisioning of what VR will be like. Probably nothing like what it will be like, but a fun envisioning. Some of the technology, in fact, most of the technology does exist. I won't give you any spoilers, I promise. I'm not going to talk about that, just about the technology involved. The star of the movie and most of the characters in the movie spend a lot of time in VR. About half the movie's animated. But they wear something that looks a little bit like a small version of the VR visor that we see today, the Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive. When he gets an upgrade, it's a little clearer. You can see through it, so it might be a little bit more augmented plus virtual reality. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell. Seems like pure virtual reality. That is where you don't see what's around you. You only see the world you're in. It also has to solve one of the biggest problems with virtual reality. Well, there's two. One is it makes people nauseous. that's actually, I think, probably the most serious problem with VR and may never be solved, the idea. And the reason is the human body's not designed to see one thing and feel another. Your brain, when your eyes tell you one thing, but your body tells you something else, that's when you get nauseated. And the reason you get nauseated, we're told by evolutionary biologists, is, well, this is actually a survival mechanism. The brain, when it gets in a situation that it knows can't be real, says, oh boy, you must have eaten some bad mushrooms. We better throw up now. Communication to the stomach. And so I'm told that's the at least the theory why this nauseates people. And that's going to be hard to fix until we can really connect directly into the brain so that the brain isn't confused. The brain says, yeah, this is exactly what's happening. Right now, though, your body knows you're not in this world. Your inner ear knows you're not. And your eyes are telling you all sorts of weird things because your eyes are focusing on a screen that's an inch or two from your eyeballs, right? That's the VR helmet. But that's where they're converging, I guess. But they're focusing. They're attempting to see something much more distant. Boy, that's a big signal to the brain that something's gone wrong. Your eyes are converging at one point and focusing at another point. Oh, that's a bad thing. It's one of the reasons I think 3D has kind of been a flop. So VR's got to solve that problem. The other problem, which is a big problem if you've used any of these, and I have both of them, the Rift and the Vive, and I've played a lot of games in them, is moving around is hard because you're tethered to a computer. You can go to an amusement park. There are virtual reality experiences where you walk around. That's a big deal. You have to build a whole thing that people can walk safely, by the way, walk around in. So the way it works when you're in your home VR system is you have a trigger, a little joystick controller that you point where you want to go, press the button, and you go, whoop, you go over there. You zip right over to that. That's not realistic. So in the movie, and by the way, these things exist. We did an interview with a company called Infinidec that makes this. It's a multi-directional treadmill. So you stand on it, and you can walk on any direction, and the platform will move. So you can walk. You can even run. The Infinidec, which I think I'm told inspired the Infinidec in the movies. The Infinidec lets you run as fast as 7 or 8 miles an hour. It sounds like a herd of elephants. Because imagine all the machinery involved. You're wearing sensors on your feet. It's sensors everywhere. And, of course, it has to have a railing all the way around it so you don't run off the darn thing and hurt yourself. This is kind of what it looks like in the movie initially, although there seem to be other technologies in the movie. At another point, there's something a little more flexible. I won't talk about it because I don't want to spoil anything. And then you have the sensory issue because you see stuff, but that's only one of your five senses. What about touch and smell and taste? And so hearing, I guess hearing and sight you can do, right? You got headphones and you got visor. Touch is the big one. So they have these sensor suits that you wear. And you can feel things. Pleasant and unpleasant, by the way. Again, no spoilers, but you'll see in the movie they demonstrate both. I gather from the movie that the idea of the visor is you're not looking at a screen, but lasers. Why is it when science fiction, when we need something, you know, really different, new, and clever, we say lasers are involved? Lasers beam directly into your retinas, the images you're seeing. Similar technologies do, believe it or not, sort of kind of exist. So the movie isn't all that far-fetched, but it's a heck of a good movie. And it's a Spielberg movie, and it has lots of Spielberg elements. And if you were alive during the 80s, you will see many old friends in many, many guises. Really fun, a lot of fun. And see it, if you can, in an Atmos theater. So you get the full surround sound effect. Dolby Atmos really does sound good. I did not see it in 3D. It is available in 3D. I have no inclination to see it in 3D, although our home theater guru yesterday said, Scott Wilkinson said, it's pretty good in 3D because there's so many 3D experiences in the movie. That's true. But it was not, interestingly, shot in 3D. It wasn't in many parts of it. It wasn't even shot in digital. It was shot 35 millimeter film. What? Spielberg's an old, how do we put this? He likes the tried and true. And another thing I did not know, but Scott Wilkinson told me, is that the computer graphics are not 4K, they're 1080p, they're high def, not ultra high def, and that's always the case. I didn't know that. Anyway, a lot of fun. It is April Fool's. I am pleased to say there are not many April Fool's jokes in the news cycle, thank goodness. But there are a few that seem like April Fool's jokes that aren't. We'll talk about those and what Google did, because Google, you know, loves April Fool's Day. We'll talk about all that. And Easter eggs, too. Actually, it's fun because the movie Ready Player One kind of revolves around an Easter egg. Kind of fun. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Kim Schaffer at the helm. She's answering the phones. Give her a ring. Mike Cozzio will be playing some fun music, probably 80s music today. We'll get to the phone calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK, Leo, the phone number. When you call that number, you'll talk to the Easter egg clad.
A little bit.
Yep. Kim Schaffer. She kind of looks like a Paisley Easter bunny.
Easter egg.
Yep. Hello, Kim Schaffer.
Hi.
Happy Easter and happy April Fool's. Has anyone punked you today?
Yeah, I woke up to a text message this morning that the restaurant I was at last night had a grease fire in the kitchen.
That's not nice.
And I looked at the front page of the newspaper and there was nothing there, so I went
That's
out.
That's not nice.
Okay, thanks.
I like funny jokes. You know, yeah. Google in years past has spent, you know, a lot of money and energy. You often felt like, gosh, I bet a third of the staff was working on this all year long on Easter. I mean, April Fool's jokes, but I don't know if there's one in Google Maps. Which
yeah,
is fun.
Where's Waldo?
Did you get that one?
I did. I'm playing right now.
So if you enter a location,
you just click on Google Maps and
it'll just
Waldo's
start up
on the side, and you click on him and then it'll start up.
Oh, fun! And it's a game. You're like looking for Waldo.
Yeah, it's just like the book.
Okay. That's easy. That's
I got
fun.
Through 5 levels and I quit.
Wow. That's a lot of... Oh, I see Waldo. I see him right there. He's just waving at you on the side there. Yeah. So where you tap him.
Tap him.
Says, where's Waldo? Waldo invited you on an April Fool's world tour. He shared his location and maps, but he's hiding in a crowd. Find him and his friends as they travel around the world. He's somewhere, I don't know where, near Aconcagua. Start game. Oh, he's in the Andes in Chile. Wow. And then so there's a Where's Waldo picture. Ooh, and you can scroll around in it and you find him, huh?
Yep. He's there somewhere. The first one's super easy.
Nope. You're not the only one to fall for that trap, it says. Oh, it's somebody who's wearing a striped shirt. I found Wenda. Who's Wenda?
Waldo's wife.
Oh, there's several in here. I'm still playing, I guess, because Wenda isn't Waldo. All right. Well, I've just wasted enough of your time. Who should I talk to? Who should I talk to?
How about Gary in Ontario, California?
All right.
Looks like he's having trouble getting his mail on
his
phone.
I love it. I am just glad. I thought no one would call on this Easter Sunday, so I'm glad.
We got a few, so yeah. Let's keep it going.
Hi, Gary. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Gary.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Happy Easter. Happy April Fool's Day. Welcome to the Tech Guy Show.
Same to you. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
My issue is I had to replace my wife's phone with the same phone at Apple. And in the process of setting up mail and everything, we realized she was not getting her email until she actually opened up the mail app and the mail would download. So I fooled with, all the things I could find on Google and come to find out that push does not work for anything. And at the point I was doing, I couldn't even get iCloud.
Let me stop you for a second. What mail app is she using, Apple's or somebody else's?
Apple's.
Okay. So her push is not, so other mail apps won't work that way in the background generally because Apple doesn't like programs running in the background. That's one way they get great battery life, is they're very restrictive about what can run in the background. Apple stuff will, but not other stuff. So Apple Mail does run in the background, and yeah, you're right, it's push, which means, so there's two directions you can go, push and pull. So traditional email is polling email, and that's still working for her. When she opens the email client, it polls the email server, asks it, you got anything for me, and it sends it. Push is the opposite direction, where you're just walking along day to day doing your daily thing, and the email server gets an email message for you, and it pushes it to your phone. And you're right. Push is fairly important. Push is how text messaging works, right? You don't have to go check to see if you got a text message. It just comes in. Does she get text messages?
That's the problem. Well, what I finally ended up doing is forwarding her. Our business has, you know, their own email, so I forward that into iCloud, and that solved the problem. And I just was wondering if Apple was going to ever fix it. So I guess
now I'm really confused. So you said other things push wasn't working. What wasn't besides email?
I have my own domain. And then I have Gmail, a couple of
I see.
Addresses.
You just weren't getting any email pushed to you.
Yeah.
Got it.
The other one. Right.
But then you triggered it somehow by forwarding business email into the iCloud. And now it's working okay.
It's working great. Yeah. And I just had to make sure that when she sent an email that it would, or replied to an email, that it would reply to her independent electronics, mail, rather than going to iCloud. And that seems to work so far. It was like a day project to get all that stuff working.
No kidding. And I don't know how, that's a strange thing. Is her main email a Gmail account?
Well, my main one is my own domain, independentelectronics.com, and it's hosted by, it was hosted by Verizon years ago, but it's some, you know, they've sold it off.
Yeah, that was Yahoo. So now, but the email that wasn't pushing, who was the email provider? Was it Gmail?
Well, Gmail wouldn't either. You have to open up the mail app, and then you'd get your mail, like you said. It would pull.
Yes. So there have been problems in the past, is why I'm asking, with Gmail push.
Right. I read about that. Right. Yeah. Supposedly it works now, but so far I haven't been able to get it to work.
So, you go into the Gmail account and you've already looked at this setting and made sure, and you know, one of the suggestions is you turn on fetch. But you really fetch, which is the same thing as poll. I just used an older term.
You don't really want fetch.
You really want push.
Well, you're kind of stuck. All my addresses, once I go in there and look at them, my independent, my Gmail, and all them, all are fetch. And they're set automatic, or at least at this point.
Yeah. So iOS has fetch methods and push methods.
Right.
Yeah. And iOS can be set to automatically fetch in the background. It's a little different than push. I prefer push. In general, you want pushing because that way your phone doesn't have to go out and every, you know, in the old email days, remember it would go every 10, you say, how often do you want to check your email? Every 10 minutes, check the email. That's a waste of battery because it wakes up the phone. The phone has to get going, fire it up and go get the mail. And if there's no mail, nothing happens, but it still uses battery. Whereas push, you know, and it doesn't have to do anything. The mail just arrives pushed to it. Saves a lot of battery life. I'm not sure why it was broken. I'm glad you found something and fixed it. It sounds like her account's the problem. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, this is interesting. Aaron K. Max says, it's a Gmail issue. Unless you have the paid G Suite account, which I bet your work does, you can't configure for push anymore in the free accounts. That's interesting. So that's a change in Gmail, I guess. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, another song from the Ready Player One generation. Mentioned in the book. I don't remember it mentioned in the movie. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Call via Skype outside that area. It should still be toll free. David on the line from Austin, Texas. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome. What can I do for you?
Let me switch from my Bluetooth headset to my iPhone.
Okay.
This is my first time ever. I'm making a call to a radio to a net program, so I'm a little nervous. Try to make it quick.
You know, I think I've only done it my whole life. I've worked in talk radio for 40 years, but I think I've only done it once myself. I know it's a little nerve wracking. It's funny because I'd been working in radio for years, and I called a radio show once, and it was terrifying.
I have to keep my mind off of it.
Here's the good news: no one's listening, David. It's just you and me.
Yeah. It's pretty cool because it's crazy. I was doing yard work and I put you into Siri. I added you to my contact list so I could tell Siri call as I was weed eating. The first time I said Siri call Leo, it went through.
What?
Anyway.
What? Wow.
So that's
good.
The getting a hold of you.
That's good. Siri knows the special back door, I guess.
Yeah. So, Leo, let me see if I can give you a... So this is kind of specific, maybe techie type stuff.
All right.
And I have a couple of other questions that are general that might be helpful to other people.
Okay.
So I want to, I work, you know, we have, I work with a small company, 10 people, and we use Dropbox as our network. That's how we share files.
Yeah. A lot of people do. It's very,
very popular. With that, though, is we're getting conflicts, and there are certain files that can, you know, we have some access databases.
This is a problem with databases. If you have two programs accessing the same file at once, you're going to have problems.
Right, right, which I've kind of encountered.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do was set up a VPN, and I'm trying to figure out, I was able to configure Hamachi and, you know, install the things and get, you know, there's some settings where...
This isn't going to fix the fundamental problem, you understand.
Right, but putting the server on a file share, I mean, putting it on a file share...
It's not going to solve the problem.
Right, right. But, well, no, then I'm not sure. No, but I'm not asking the Dropbox. The network, the VPN, is for two people in remote locations. So I was going to put the file off of the server in one, on a Windows server, and then people are going to access it. But I just need to connect.
It's not going to solve the problem.
Okay, I'm not sure I...
The problem is, doesn't matter how it's stored or whether it's VPN or Hamachi, if you've got two people accessing the same file...
No, but access does allow you...
It has to support locking. It has to support locking, record locking.
Microsoft does. Microsoft does. Microsoft Access does.
Well, then it would work on Dropbox.
No, because Dropbox sees each person's... No, because when you're accessing Dropbox, you're accessing it on your PC. When you're accessing,
Yeah. I see what you're saying. They're accessing it locally. You're right. If you have it on a central server, I got it. If you have it on a central server, Access's file locking will work. So any program that's designed to be multi-user has to be very careful about two people accessing the file at the same time. So the way it'll work in a database program is they'll lock the record down that's being edited until that person releases it. Yeah.
Right. At some point, I'm looking at going to SQL Server and...
Yeah, you'd be much better off with a database designed for this. Access is notoriously problematic. But you're right. I apologize. You did solve the initial problem because Dropbox isn't a single source of information. It's not one file. It's two different files, one on each computer, and that's never going to work.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, and the problem is, I guess I could access a Dropbox if they were at the same location... But then I'm throwing stuff out. But the VPN part is, so the Hamachi works, and you know. But I just wanted to see if you could recommend a Hamachi, you know, whatever that...
I wouldn't do Hamachi. Hamachi tricks the network into looking like a local network. And that while it's very cool, it probably isn't the way to solve this problem. You really want to do it. This is a business production app, right? This is not a hobby.
The only thing is,
for instance, do this wrong and the entire database gets corrupted.
Right.
That's not good.
It's low usage database, so I think we could, if nothing else, I'll try it out. But would an open VPN?
No. What you want is a file server. And you want a file server that is accessible. Any network attached storage solution, we call them NASs, NAS, will do this. You just with a NAS, you're going to be using Microsoft's file sharing technology over the internet. You don't need a VPN. You're trying to basically trick it into thinking it's local when
that's
it's
correct.
Not. Right. What you want is a solution that handles file sharing appropriately using the technology Microsoft provides to do exactly this. You still may have problems with Access because Access isn't, but it's supposed to work, but it's notoriously bad for multi-user. So eventually you're probably going to go to some sort of SQL solution. But nevertheless, what you want is a network attached storage. You need this for your business anyway. A network attached storage server. It becomes a file server. And the file sits on that and is accessible both locally over the network and over the internet. And that you may want to use a VPN for privacy. But a good NAS will provide the VPN as well. So your NAS, you'll be logging into the VPN server and using the file as if it's local. even if you are off-site. So that's a really good solution. Synology makes excellent NASs. That's the one I use, and they will do all of this. So basically,
I heard you recommend Synology.
Yeah.
If I need a, do they have like a basic setup that doesn't, you know, require, you know, I'm not hosting, you know, multimedia files. I'm basically,
yeah, you can. So the way Synology works is you get the same software on all of their NASs. It's the price is determined by how many drives are in it. And I think given that this is a business database and, you know, data corruption is an issue, you'd probably want a two drive Synology NAS.
Sure. Okay.
That's for redundancy. And you'd probably, you know, what you would really like to do is have an offsite copy of the NAS software.
Right. And I'm familiar with that. I have a Western Digital. I have a All Western right. Digital NAS that you told me not to, that you told somebody else.
Yeah, I'm not a fan, but it's the same idea. And then I think you'd be fine. Now the trick, of course, is going to be the person who's offsite, and that is where you want to use a VPN because you want the traffic encrypted. That's how VPNs started. Is businesses wanted their employees to be able to log in locally, remotely. And so that's the good solution. And a good NAS will have that. Synology has that capability built in. Do you have somebody who runs your business network, your office network, an IT guy?
I am the IT guy.
That's what I thought.
I'm a developer, IT guy.
So you get to do it all.
Right.
So you're going to have to, I presume you have some sort of protection, a firewall protection on your network, your corporate network, business network.
Yes.
You're going to have to probably put the VPN at that firewall. So whatever you're using for protection, you're going to want to see if that supports a VPN that the off-site employees can access. They'd log in using their – the good news is all computer software, all operating systems now come with VPN, so it's a very simple thing for them to log in. They'll log into that VPN at the edge, right? That's where they're going to log in. That's where your router is, at the edge. That puts them in the corporate network. And then your Synology NAS or whatever NAS you're using is a file share on the corporate network that everybody can see at every desk if you give them permission to. And the VPN remote user can log in through the VPN to that NAS. And that's the best way to do that.
Well, because we don't – I mean, we're a fairly small organization. We're 10 people, so we don't have – you know, we don't have a separate fire. We use an Asus router.
Okay, that's fine. Check with that Asus router, see if it supports VPN. Most routers do now, even consumer routers. If not, you might want to get one that's a little bit more beefy. I'm not much bigger than you, but we have all sorts of intrusion detection and sophisticated firewalls between us and the outside world. You just have to these days. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You can actually get a Synology NAS router. Synology makes excellent routers, so that would be another choice for you. But look and see first if that Asus that you have has VPN. Many Asuses do, if it's a late model Asus.
It is a late model. I had a couple of general purposes.
Sure.
I don't know.
Sure. Does that all make sense, though?
That makes sense.
That's the best way to do it. Yeah, Hamachi is not a good idea because now that you'd be much better off doing a VPN to your business, you know, to the edge of the business, and then using a NAS or some other file sharing system inside the business to make the file available.
Okay.
And that solves a lot of other problems. If this is, you know, it's worth doing it right because then you have more protection and more flexibility down the road.
Yeah. I mean, I purchased I have a second office that I purchased, like a Netgear router.
Yep.
The Asus work has an open VPN, VPN in part, as part of the
perfect.
Router. This Netgear had a kind of a very slim pickings with its open VPN stuff.
Right.
It was, you know, so it kind of was useless.
Take a look at the Synology. I mean, the Synology NAS is excellent.
Right.
And it's router is excellent. And it's it's kind of midway between a consumer router and a business router. It's got a lot of nice features. And that would work perfectly well with this environment.
Okay. I do have a couple quick generic questions.
Sure, go ahead.
So over the last year or so, I've been buying a couple laptops with touch. And on one of Lenovo's I bought, a Yoga, we had to turn off the touch feature because it was doing phantom touching and ghost touching or whatever.
Yeah, I have a Lenovo Yoga. It does not do that. That's something wrong with the Yoga. Unless it could be the trackpad. You make sure the trackpad's turning off when you're typing.
Yeah, I mean, I've had two, I have an Acer that also does that, and it seems like it, I don't know, I thought maybe it was a Windows update, because sometimes it would come and go.
No, I have a million, I have at least a half dozen Windows machines with touch. None of them have any phantom touch issues.
Okay, no, that's fine. I just wanted, because I haven't been able to find information about
that. Yeah, I don't know what that's coming from. I would take a look, certainly, at the touchpad.
Okay.
Make sure that's being look in the settings. Make sure that's being disabled while you're typing.
Okay, it's pretty crazy you talking back to me, Leo.
Oh, it's fun. I'm glad you called.
You kept me company. I was in Germany. I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago for about 8 months, and your podcast. This was before the smartphones came out to some degree, right around the time. I was going to say, I had you on my iPod.
That's nice. Thank you. Hey, one thing the chat room is suggesting, and I think this is true more and more, instead of running a server locally, you could also use Microsoft's cloud services.
Yeah. We have some sensitive data.
Yeah, yeah. And all the more reason you want to do this right.
Right. And that kind of goes counter to what you're saying about you need professional protection, which is not what I'm doing.
Yeah. I mean, that's all the more reason. You might actually be safer in Azure than you would be if you don't have a well-secured environment at work. But nevertheless,
I saw that.
Yeah, I think you can trust Azure. I mean, what you're going to want, I don't know what business you're in, but you're going to want something that's compliant with whatever privacy regulations are current in your business. There's financial services requirements. There's HIPAA, of course, for medical providers. And Microsoft offers compliant storage in all those situations. So that's what you want, is something that's HIPAA compliant or PCI compliant or whatever it is, whatever regulations your industry needs. And I think Microsoft especially is very sensitive to these issues and will do a good job protecting your data. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. It's an interesting world we're living in, really in the middle right now of a transition. And you're actually seeing this at Microsoft. You saw that this week at Microsoft. A transition from doing everything locally, like our last caller who wanted a file server in his office and allowing his employees to log in remotely to use the file server. That's kind of the old school way. And more, and I'm sure you're aware of this, he was kind of trying to bridge the gap with Dropbox, right? More and more we're seeing that with cloud services. Chatroom said, and I completely agree with him, that probably the best thing for the caller would be to call his Microsoft rep and say, I want Azure in the cloud. I want cloud services. I want to put my Access database in the cloud, have a multi-user setup. It would be secure, probably more secure, frankly, than his office is, given that he's using a consumer-grade router for his firewall protection and tried to use Dropbox for file sharing. You should probably know if privacy is an issue for you. The cloud providers like Microsoft's OneDrive and Dropbox, Apple's iCloud, none of them are compliant with things like the HIPAA regulation, because in every case, the company has access to that data. So a rogue employee at Dropbox or Apple or Microsoft could see that data. And that's, of course, a privacy issue. You can, though, get HIPAA-compliant storage or PCI-compliant or storage is compliant with whatever technologies and security required by your industry from Microsoft and other companies. You just have to call them and say, this is what I need, and I need it to be private and secure, and I don't want you to have the keys. I don't want anybody to have the keys except, duly designated employees. And you can do that. And it would be a lot simpler and, frankly, probably a lot more secure. I know we talk a lot about data breaches and data loss and so forth. There was just another one at MyFitnessPal, which is run by Under Armour. And I got an email, you probably did too, if you've ever used MyFitnessPal, saying, oh, well, sorry. Whoopsies. But those are big online public databases, a little easier to hack, and certainly a better target, a much more interesting target for bad guys than your particular application. So I think you'd be a lot better off talking to Microsoft. And they may even steer you away from access to SQL Server, somewhat more powerful Microsoft solution for this kind of multi-user environment. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. 8888, ask Leo the phone number. Back to the phones we go. Line 2, Kenny, Kansas City, Missouri. Hello, Kenny.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well, how are you?
Doing good.
What's up? Happy Easter? Happy April Fools?
Happy Easter. Yep. I bought looking at buying a router, and I can't remember the company who makes it. It's called something Archer 9.
Yes, that's the TP-Link.
Oh, okay, TP-Link.
Yeah.
And I want to know if that was a...
Yeah, the Archers are very good. In fact, for a long time, the Wirecutter, which is one of the places I really like to refer people to for things like router recommendations, they're run by the New York Times, but they were started by a friend, Brian Lamb, who used to work at Gizmodo. And the whole idea was, Brian said, you know, we always give these reviews and you say there's 15 different appropriate things for this particular use. What if we did a review site that just said, this is the one to get? This is the one you should get. And that the Wirecutter was born, and they've really grown. And one of the things I like about them, they're one of the last technology publications that does extensive testing. They use experts and they test them all, and so they don't. Unfortunately, they don't. They stopped recommending the TP-Link. I don't think because there's anything wrong with it. They used to like the Archer C7, but they are always testing. Now they recommend the Nighthawk, the Netgear Nighthawk R7000P, as their pick. Doesn't mean that Archer is not a great router. It is. TP-Link makes very nice stuff, affordable stuff. That was one of the reasons they picked it, is the price was right. It's a good selection, shall we say. I have my favorites, and nowadays I'm really kind of fond of the mesh systems because they just seem to solve a lot of problems people have with Wi-Fi. But, you know, different routers for different people. Depends what you need. Let's see. Let's take a little break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more about tech with you at 8888-ASK-LEO. Don't forget the website is techilabs.com. That's where you can get all the answers to all the questions and links. And even if you're yelling at the radio saying, I got an idea, you can even put your ideas up there. Your comments are more than welcome. And it's free. techilabs.com. Todd, he's next. Palmdale, California. Hello, Todd.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. What can I do for you, sir?
Yes, I had a friend, and then 5 years ago, she had a device for her home phone, and it was, I don't know what it did, but it made it mobile. She could go out throughout our town and use it.
Yeah, no, there's no good way to do that. You can do it the other direction. Maybe that's what she was doing. Because if you have a cell phone, there are many devices that turn that cell phone into your home phone. You can dock the cell phone into a docking station, and then it looks like you've got a regular home phone, a cordless home phone, answering machine and all that stuff, but it's tied to your cell phone. There's no way, if you think about it, you know, maybe you're thinking a walkie-talkie or some sort of a radio solution that she would have in her house. The transmitter she would have to do that would be really significant, you know? I mean, there are walkie-talkies with many miles ranges, and so I guess you could do it with a walkie-talkie solution, but I don't think that's a good alternative. And, of course, as soon as you get out of range, your phone no longer works. Take a look at going the other direction. Frankly, that's what most people are doing. I think fewer and fewer people are subscribing to landline phone service. Almost everybody carries a phone in their pocket wherever they are. What do you need a different phone for your home? So if you want a, you know, like a field, something that feels like a wired phone, you can get a base station you'd plug that smartphone into. But I don't think you'd want to go the other direction. It's the only technology I could think of is a kind of a walkie-talkie technology, but that's not going to go more than a couple of miles. Now, if you're an amateur radio enthusiast, there's solutions out there. Maybe she was a ham. You could do that. Hams often carry what they call handy talkies with them that broadcast over the ham bands, but you have to be licensed to do that. But if you have a handy talkie, oh, there's all sorts of things you can do. if you're an amateur radio enthusiast. I think the best thing to do is get a cell phone. You have to pay a subscription fee, but you have to do that for a landline anyway. And I tell you, I don't think anybody under 25 is ever going to get a landline ever again. Are you listening? Let me ask you, are you under 25? Do you have a landline? Now, I'm not talking about mom and dad. They may have a landline. I don't even think my kids understand the difference. Like, they come home and they're not going to, when they rent their first apartment, they don't get a landline. Well, I got a phone. What do I need a landline for? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. You're a geek. I know you're a geek. You're listening to this podcast, right? You love technology. Maybe you're interested in a career in technology. It's hard to get that first job, isn't it? Because you have experience, but you don't have professional experience. It's your first job in IT, after all. That's why they have this certification program where you take a test and you study and you learn about a particular area of IT. There are many, many certs. But I'll tell you, the best place to go to learn the material you need to take the practice exams to prepare yourself for a lucrative, satisfying job in IT, it's IT Pro TV. Tim and Don have been IT trainers for more than a decade. They created IT Pro TV as a fun and engaging way to learn the skills you need to get a job in this demanding business. But the good news is there are a lot of jobs open right now. More than a million IT security jobs open right now. You love this stuff. Why not make it a living? Go to itpro.tv/techguy for your chance to sign up and try IT Pro TV today. 3,300 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training. More than 100 hours created new each week. You can watch live. You can chat in the chat room just like we do. And stream it everywhere. They have a Chromecast app. They have a iOS Android app. They have Fire TV, Apple TV. Very nice Apple TV app, by the way. Roku. You can watch it on your big screen TV. You can listen on the go in the car. You can watch at home, at work, on your computer. You can even download courses for on-the-go learning. Skip the boring voiceover slide snooze fest of most IT training and empower your team with interactive IT training they'll actually enjoy watching at itpro.tv. Go to itpro.tv/techguy. Use the offer code TG30. You'll get 7 days free. And 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active account. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams and virtual labs. I think a very fair $857 a year, but use TG30. You'll only pay $600 a year when you go to itpro.tv/techguy. That's the offer code TG30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. itpro.tv/techguy. Don't forget that offer code TG30. 90,000 IT Pro TV members now. Most of them, I think, watch our shows. Thank you, Tim and Don. itpro.tv/techguy. Use the offer code TG30. Yeah, it's absolutely worth it. The Transcender exams alone are $99 a year. And practicing the test before you take it is a great way to do it. We have a lot of our listeners are at IT Pro TV. A lot of them. I know, because I went to their opening party in Gainesville of the new studios, and everybody said, say hi to Steve. Both people in IT and people who want to get into IT. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that tech right here on this one show. All you have to do if you have a question or a comment or a suggestion is call me, 8888-ASK-LEO. Holiday, so that usually means on a holiday weekend the phones are a little slow. Good time if you've been trying to get in the past and couldn't get through the busy signals. This would be a good time to call 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S., or Canada. Outside that area, you can still use Skype and it should be toll-free. Website, techguylabs.com. That's free. No sign-up. And everything we talk about on the show is there. Lots of links and information. techguylabs.com. Let's go back to the phones. Line 4, Ray in Homosassa, Florida. Hello, Ray.
Hello, Will. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
You bet.
I tried to call many times. However, you know, you're a very successful, busy guy. And today, I
fooled you, I guess, huh?
Today, I was listening to you. I listen to you almost every time it's on. But anyway, today I was listening to it and listening to the program, and you comment that you were surprised that anybody was calling in today, and I thought, gee, this might be my chance.
It is. It worked. Woohoo!
Yeah, it did. It worked.
You didn't even have to use Siri to call. You just did it.
No. That's way above my tech grade. I don't have it. Listen. I have a problem, an ongoing problem that's been ongoing. When I say ongoing, I'm saying 2 months. I have a Chromebook, and it's the latest one. I think I've had it, I don't know, 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
I also have an online bank account. I don't know if you want me to mention the name of the bank.
Oh, I don't care. We don't have to keep it a secret particularly.
Okay, well,
is it a well-known bank?
Capital One.
Okay, Capital One. Like them. They're a sponsor, so I'll say nice things about them.
Oh, really?
I didn't
realize that.
Their credit card is because they have a virtual numbers system, which I really think is great, and I'm glad to spread the word about, where you don't use your main credit card number online. You use the virtual one. It's with that bot they have called Eno. But that's neither here nor there. So you say you have a Chromebook, you have a Capital One account, and what's going on? You can't log in?
Okay. I have an investment account there, which is separate, and then I have a bank account, savings and checking.
Okay.
And here's the problem. Everything works okay.
You know, I'm saying there's nothing that doesn't work as far as implementing what I wanted to do. I have direct deposit there. I have payments that are made through there automatically. I travel some, and so I don't ever want to worry about it. And I have everything up pretty much on automatic payment. Now, 2 months ago, or thereabouts, I cannot change or access my checking account or savings account online.
What happens?
Well, you know how it comes up and says password, not a.
It doesn't recognize your password.
And the frustrating thing about this is that I've been going through this with the company. You know, with the bank, with the representing people, with the tech people, with everybody. And what it does is it loops me back and keeps looping me back.
Now, let me cut the chase here a little bit. So you go online and you do it in your Chromebook, so you're using the browser Chrome, and you enter your name and your password, and you're sure that that's the correct name and password. And then what happens? Does it say that's not right?
Yes.
And then you call the bank, you call Capital One, and you say, I can't log in. And then they reset your password, right?
Right.
And then you got the new password, and it still won't let you log in.
Sometimes it will let me log in once or twice. But that's it. Then it gets reversed back.
So you're a good candidate, and I would turn this on for what Chrome calls autofill. Most browsers do this, and generally I don't recommend using it because, it's not quite as secure as using LastPass or some sort of password manager, which I strongly prefer. But I don't get the feeling that you're going to be using a password manager. And frankly, if this is, you know, mostly what you're doing, Ray, is banking, and because you're on a very secure platform, a Chromebook, I'm going to suggest you turn on Chrome's password memorization feature, because then when you type it correctly once, it'll remember it, and from then on it'll type it for you. My guess is that there's some key or something that's not maybe it's a strange to enter it, or maybe it's you're typing L and it wants a 1. That's a really common one. In fact, when I use my password manager to generate passwords, I always say, don't use any characters that are ambiguous, like L and 1 and O and 0. I probably shouldn't say this out loud because it narrows down the total possible passwords I could be using. You never want to do that. But in this case, I'm not too worried, but because my passwords usually are very, very long and very, very confusing and not memorable. That's why you use a password manager. I'm going to say use a password. And if you go into Chrome and you go into the settings section, this is true of every browser, but since you're on a Chromebook, I know you're using Chrome. Every browser will have a way to remember passwords. In this case, it's under the advanced tab. So you go to the very bottom of the settings page. You click that three dots in the right-hand corner and you select settings. Then you go to the very bottom of that page, you'll see advanced. You open that up, and if you scroll down even a little bit more, you'll see a area that says passwords and forms, and then under that, manage passwords. And you can turn on, there's an on-off switch right at the top, the ability to remember passwords. If you turn it on, it'll offer to remember a password the next time you type it, and you won't have to type it again. And it's my guess that that's what's going on here, that you've got a password that's hard to get right. And of course, banks, as they should, are very cautious. If you enter a password incorrectly more than once, sometimes they'll just say, you better call us. They don't want bad guys to attempt to log in many times guessing a password. So, Ray, that's my suggestion. And for everybody else, it really is a good idea. You can use the password manager in the browser to remember passwords, and that's fine, especially if the password manager is password protected itself, you know, and yours is because you're on a Chromebook. You can't get in without a password in your Chromebook. But my strong suggestion for almost everybody is to get a password manager. For one reason, it goes across machines. You can have it on multiple different computers, and it can be on your smartphone too. The one I use happens to be a sponsor, but I've been using it for many more years than they've been a sponsor. They're a brand new sponsor on the shows. It's called LastPass, but there's 1Password. There's many, many different companies that make these password vaults. Any of them would be better than no password vault. LastPass is my personal favorite. It keeps these passwords safe. You still have 1Password, the password you use to log into your password vault, but everything else is automatically filled in. And because of that, you can use much longer, much more random passwords, better passwords, because you don't have to remember them. The password vault does. So for you, Ray, just turn on the password manager in Google Chrome and let it remember the passwords. For everybody else, probably worth, you know, checking into a password manager. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Happy Easter and happy April Fools. And those haven't come together since I was born, I think. More of your calls right after this. Hey, Christopher.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Good to be back.
I saw those pictures. Just looking at those pictures made me cold. All the ice. Oh my God.
You would have enjoyed it. So that's the one thing I want to talk about today is the Arctic adventure, the photography there, some of the videography.
Pictures of ice.
Well, pictures of ice and doing working with cameras and ice and how to work around some of the nice issues.
Do you
there
have some pictures you want me to show?
I just sent you an email with a bunch of links. One to a video playlist because I did like a little short video documentary.
Fun.
I'm not calling it a vlog, but something along those lines.
And it was fun, and it was you had a good time.
It was amazing. It was so amazing. Oh, it was such a wild ride. Literally, I mean, we were out on the open sea. I'll tell you when we're on the air.
All right. It's kind of fun for me anyway. I don't know what, you know, I really wonder what 20-somethings are thinking when they see this movie Ready Player One and they hear all this great 80s music that they never heard. I guess they wouldn't know what they're hearing. But boy, for people of a certain age, people born in the, I guess the 70s or earlier, it's really fun. It is really fun. My wife and I are sitting in there and we're rocking out to the music. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo the phone number. Line one is Josh in Sutter, California. Hey, Josh.
Hey, how's it going, Leo?
It's going great. How are you?
Yeah, doing well, my friend.
What can I do for you? Hey.
Okay, so I have this lovely QNAP NAS server here.
Yep, those are great. I love the QNAPs.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. And so I have 2 6 terabytes in there right now, and I have two. It's a four bay setup. And last night I get a notification from Amazon that you know, it's National Backup Day or something like that, and they have the special on some other brand of hard drive, a Toshiba, where I have Western Digital in mine. And I'm like, I'm rattling my brain. Do I go for this deal, this Toshiba 6 terabyte, or do I go back and do I get a Western Digital 4 terabyte to put in there? You know, just so. What do you think about mixing different brands of hard drive?
Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. There are only a couple of hard drive companies left. So, but if you look at failure rates, I'll tell you, the real issue to me is it's better in a NAS to get a NAS drive, a drive that's designed not necessarily for speed. Most NAS drives are 5,400 RPM, but designed for low heat and long lifespan. But I'm sure if that's, you know, if it was their World Backup Day offer, that's exactly what that was. I'm looking at reliability studies. And, you know, a number of companies have done these. Google has. Of course, they use more hard drives than anybody. This is an article from last November in Make Use Of, which is a good site, makeuseof.com. And they're talking about. Actually, it's really the review comes from Extreme Tech, which is a great site from Ziff Davis, does a annualized hard drive failure report. And the most reliable hard drives, according to that, number one, Western Digital Red, which is probably what you're already using. That's a NAS-oriented hard drive. The next is the Toshiba. Its number is MD04ABA400V, but then HGST, which are a lot of people really like the HGST drives from, is it Hitachi? Backblaze uses those, and those are very good. And then Seagate, and then Western Digital Black. But as far as the notion of mixing them, no problem.
Oh, good.
If the QNAP is using traditional RAID, then remember that your RAID array can only be as big as the smallest drive in it times the number of drives. So, but QNAP may be. I know most companies now use beyond, you know, some different kinds of RAID that allow you heterogeneous drive collections in there. So that's just something to be aware of. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Don't worry about it, in other words. Take advantage of the deal. Happy Easter. You had a little Easter egg in your mailbox. I didn't mention it yesterday. It was World Backup Day. I'm surprised Carbonite didn't ping me and say, hey, mention this in the ads or something like that. But, yeah, yesterday was World Backup Day. And it's good to read these roundups. Backblaze, which is another competitor, actually, to Carbonite, backup company, had a report from its 2017 hard drive use. They had 10,000 hard drives that they tested. They said enterprise drives have a 1.61% failure rate over 300,000 days. Consumer drives, 1.60 failure rate over 420,000 days. In other words, there was no statistical difference between enterprise drives and consumer drives, which may indicate it's not worth spending the extra money for a so-called enterprise drive. It's hard to parse all the data. Extreme Tech has an article from last month that's probably worth reading. Who makes the most reliable hard drives? They refer to the Backblaze report as well. And, you know, they've kind of narrowed it down and so forth. I'll have to, you know, one of the things Extreme Tech says is you take the usual grain of salt on this. So my basic impression is, and you'll hear people, everybody has an opinion on this one. If you go to Reddit or the forums or you read it even in our chat room, and One guy will say, oh, you got to use HGST. No question. Oh, that's nuts. Western Digital Red. That's the only. People will fight over this. It's kind of my guess that they're all pretty much the same nowadays. But occasionally you'll get a blip. Western Digital had a bad batch about 5 years ago. And people to this day still say, I'll never use Western Digital again. But it's not. You know, these companies are constantly improving the product. I wouldn't worry about it too much. I don't think it matters. 8888 Ask Leo. You could disagree with me. The easiest way to do that, either call or go to our website, techguylabs.com. We take comments there, and we're always welcoming your thoughts, even if they are, Leo is so wrong. I happen to know the best hard drives in the world are XYZ. Because all of that's, you know, valuable. Good to have. Guess who's back? He was sailing. Crazy person. He was sailing up in the north, up by the North Pole. It's winter, isn't it? Yes, it is. He was sailing on a sailing boat up in the Svalbard area. Took some amazing pictures, mostly of ice-coated things, including himself. He's back, our photo guy, Chris Marquardt, with photo tips for photography in extreme temperatures. I'm thinking really, really cold. So stay tuned. That's coming up in just a bit. We welcome Chris Marquardt back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm going to call him the crazy German. It's time for Chris Marquardt's photo segment. And we've been looking, and you can do it too, at video from his most recent adventure. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Hi, Leo.
Welcome back. Wow. You sailed to 78 degrees north.
Yes, that was the plan, and that's what we did. So let me step back a little. Last year in May, we chartered a ship, a two-mast schooner. It sailed around Svalbard, which is the archipelago at 78 degrees north. It's amazing. It's cold, of course, because it's in the Arctic. And I just got to know the owners a bit better. And when they sailed from northern Norway up to Svalbard, which they do once a year, and then after 6 months, they sail back down, the opportunity came up for me to join them. So I did, and it was not a photo tour. It wasn't not a cruise. It was pretty much a part of the crew there. And we sailed up from the north of Norway, from Tromsø up to Svalbard, to 78 degrees north. And that means we had to go through the open sea, through the Barents Sea. And it took us about 3 days to get through there, and we had pretty strong winds, gale force winds, which means the ship was leaning to the side quite a bit, because the winds came from east and we were going straight north, so it was kind of a 90 degree
you understand.
Wind coming up.
This is many people's, mine included, nightmare. This would
I totally understand. For me, it's one of those experiences, one of those adventurous experiences that I don't want to miss, and it You know, I kind of like putting myself in a situation that I can't easily get out of. So I have to pull through, and that kind of helps me. I don't know. Honestly, yes, of course, there were a few cold moments in there at these winds, especially having like a watch in the night, because we had to be out there steering the ship and watching out for icebergs and things. So that wasn't always super fun, but then you go back into the ship, it's nicely heated, it's warm, you can charge your batteries, you can have a cup of coffee, a tea, maybe even a whiskey. You know, it's a wonderful mixture of adventure, of camaraderie. You get really close with the people on the ship.
Oh, I bet you do. I bet you do.
We have, everyone has their own cabin, their own showers and everything. So it was not uncomfortable.
Did you get any photography in, or was it all?
Well, that was the goal. That was the goal. Well, I had three goals. The first goal was, of course, to be a good member of the crew to help get the ship up there.
Yeah, because you weren't a tourist. You were working.
Yeah, exactly. I was working. We were packing the ship initially. Then we were 3 days at sea. Then we were unpacking the ship, getting it ready for the next tourist group, because that's how they make their money. Then that's how I got to meet them. They have tourists on the ship, so we prepared that. But yeah, that was the first goal, to get up there. The second goal was to get some video footage from that. I wanted to do a video documentary. It was not a photo tour. I didn't have any clients with me. So we were nine people in total on the ship. And so the videography was really important. And that was successful. I ended up making a little 7-part video series that I've put up on YouTube. And you have the links to that. So whoever's interested in
we've been watching those. It. What's the YouTube channel?
Chris Marquardt, Chris Marquardt.
Okay. So you should be able to go right to that. And those are really fun to watch. I'm looking at the pictures you brought back. Great still images too.
So the videography was my first production priority, so to speak. And I had an elaborate setup, an external microphone, and my 7D Mark II with the right lens and a Gorilla Pod under it, like a real vlogger setup, you know, a YouTuber setup. And that was just so not feasible with the wind, with the weather.
Oh, really?
I pretty much stayed in the cabin. But I also had like a little GoPro type action camera, and that ended up being one of the main cameras that I used because that's easily fits in the pocket, was reasonably waterproof.
And it's basically the Blair Witch Project, but instead of spooky stuff, it's freezing stuff. Then you're in the cabin going, it's a little cold out there, and the wind is blowing.
Hey, but the ship has central heating. It was beautiful, nice, and cozy and warm.
I'm amazed you would leave the inside.
If you have a shift, the ship at one point was actually covered in ice. We had with wind chill about -7 Fahrenheit at one point.
Wow.
Which was really cold.
Really cold.
And then, of course, my third priority was the photography, the still photography. Yeah. And I have my usual setup, my DSLRs. I'm still a DSLR shooter. Didn't bring mirrorless for this one. Had my typical set of lenses, one long lens, a 70-300 for the longer shots, and my 24 tilt shift. That's my go-to lens for wide-angle photography.
You use a Canon 5D Mark IV, I think, right?
That's one of the two cameras.
Is that weather-sealed? Is that designed for this kind of extreme weather?
Oh, yeah. It is at least splash-proof, so no problems there whatsoever. Also, temperature-wise, the batteries, okay, this was not far out away from power sources. There's a regular power outlet in the cabin, so I was never further away from electricity than maybe a half a minute. So it wasn't really a big deal, so I could always charge. But even with that, at least the original batteries, the manufacturer's batteries, no issues with those whatsoever. So they worked really well, even in those temperatures. I think -7 Fahrenheit is a bit under what they tell you where you should use the camera. But hey, I tend to get pictures this way that other people don't get because I kind of sometimes go over those. No, I'm not. No.
Now, is there an issue with condensation when you go from the cold outside into the warm, damp air of the inside?
There is condensation, and of course, if you have a camera at these temperatures and it's nicely cooled through and then you go inside, there will be condensation. It was never an issue, though. I wasn't coming in and trying to take pictures right away, so it took maybe 10, 15 minutes for the camera to just warm up a bit, and then the condensation would go away. So
That's encouraging, though. That means that camera handled it very well. I was going to bring the Canon 5D to Antarctica when we went.
No problem.
It wasn't as cold. It was summertime. But
True. Yeah.
People were still saying, "Well, you got to worry. You got to be careful. You don't want to go from hot to cold and cold to hot. That can kind of cause problems." It sounds like you sailed through it like a champ. And boy, your pictures are great.
It didn't cause problems. I do have two pieces of equipment with me all the time, though, and one is a shower cap, like you find in a hotel room.
Okay.
Well, you can put this if there's splashes of water coming over the board and splashing onto you. You can protect your camera this way. Just pull that over; it doesn't take up any space.
That's a good
idea. The other one is a microfiber cloth, like one you would find in a kitchen cloth. Simple, cheap. Get them in a grocery store in a 5-pack for a few bucks. Those microfiber cloths can pick up water really quickly. So if the camera gets wet, you can wipe it down. If the lens gets foggy, you can wipe it down. And then if that cloth is wet, it'll dry in almost no time. So you have it ready to go within minutes again. So that's the two pieces of equipment that belong in the pocket in extreme conditions.
And what was the problem with shooting with the 7D and the tripod? Was it just too windy and the boat was
We had wind up to wind force 8, which is gale force winds, yeah, and the wind coming from 90 degrees. So the ship was leaning on the side, and it wasn't really well. And then it was moving quite a bit, crazy. So it wasn't really feasible to put the tripod somewhere that had been washed overboard.
Discover the topfloor.com. Find Chris's pictures, his videos, his trip to Svalbard, and he'll be back next week with more wonderful photo advice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Wow. Wow. Beautiful pictures, though. You can see why National Geographic sends their people into places like this, because you get just amazing pictures that nobody else is getting, right? You know?
Oh, by the way, the Svalbard is also an amazing location to do a vacation. You can go dog sledding. You can go snowmobiling. There are saunas. You can go hiking. There are glacier caves. There's a lot of stuff to see up there, and a lot of stuff. If you like the snow, if you like the cold, highly recommended to go there.
I don't like the cold. It was 48 degrees, and I said, Lisa, we're moving somewhere warmer.
You know, when I was cheating a bit, though, because when we had those watches and I was out on the wheel holding the course, I had hand warmers in my gloves.
Good idea.
So little chemical hand warmers to keep me from freezing in too much. And that was good. I love it.
You have a whole blog post, a bunch of posts about it as well on your blog. So that's cool. ChrisMarquardt.com. Wow. Really neat. Really neat. All 80s all the time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Another song from Ready Player One's soundtrack. All those 80s songs back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. Back to the phones. We go line 3, Neil, Phoenix, Arizona. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Well, happy Easter, first of all, and thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Happy Easter.
Yeah. We talked a couple weeks ago, and just so you know, I actually got streaming problem solved by going to YouTube, so that works great, by the way.
Good. Yeah, YouTube is a good streamer, so I'm glad that works for you.
Yeah. Now, the question I had is this. I ended up trading up my iPhone 8 Plus to an iPhone 10.
All right.
I took the 8 Plus. That's not really the question, but it just brings up an issue here, which is simply, or a question, which is, should I be using Wi-Fi calling rather than normal cell service if it's available to me?
Well, the cell company would like you to do that. I can tell you that right now. T-Mobile offers it. I'm not sure who else offers it. It is a capability of the phone itself, but unless your carrier gives it to you as an option, it's not going to make any difference if the phone can do it.
I have Verizon, and they offer it.
And they do offer it. So if you think about it, you can imagine why Verizon might like it. It doesn't use their cell towers at all. It uses your internet access to make a phone call, which eliminates congestion for them. And, good news, they could still charge you by the minute. You might or might not want to use it. It doesn't. It's going to go against your own bandwidth wherever you are, whether you're at work or at home or at a coffee shop. It's going to count against that bandwidth. Nowadays, I don't think that's a big issue for most people. We have so much bandwidth. If we have bandwidth caps, that it's not going to be a big deal. Quality could vary. If you're on a poor connection, you'd rather be on the cell phone, because that the standard for audio quality on the cell phone is consistent, pretty much. Less so on Wi-Fi. But if you're at home and you know your Wi-Fi is good, the call should sound good. And in some cases, I don't know about Verizon. I know with T-Mobile, sometimes my Wi-Fi calls sound spectacular, because T-Mobile is using more bandwidth than they would normally use. The whole phone system sounds...
I'm on the Wi-Fi right now. I'm on cellular right now as I talk to you. That's a comparison.
Yeah. So you're on cellular right now?
Yes.
Yeah. Your Wi-Fi might sound better. You should try it and see if you sound better. If you do, that would be maybe the one argument for doing that. Mostly, this is to benefit the cell companies. It would benefit you also if you had a weak cell system, you know, what weak cell signal where you are. You know, the Wi-Fi signal might be better. We have, for instance, many of my employees have T-Mobile. I use T-Mobile, and there's no T-Mobile signal inside our offices here. So we have, we got from T-Mobile a special device that converts, you know, that so basically becomes a Wi-Fi tower, a cell tower with Wi-Fi access. And so we don't even have to have Wi-Fi calling to use it. It just looks like a cell tower, but it's really just using our Wi-Fi. And that gives us, you know, lots of what looks like cellular bandwidth inside the studio. So, you know, and that's a case where Wi-Fi calling might be of value. I think the only benefit really is, you know, the strongest benefit is to the company because they're not paying for cell bandwidth. But if you see it sounds better or if it works better for you in some locations, go ahead and use it. Get it?
Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the question. That's a great question, actually. You know, unless somebody can tell me a reason why it's better for you, I think it really the reason they offer it is it's better for the company. Is there any reason you could think of it? If you have a poor signal, I guess. And if I don't think Verizon does this, actually. I think Verizon sounds the same. The whole quality of your phone calls is very low, isn't it? And it goes back to the time that Ma Bell set up phone service in the United States. I mean, we're talking 100 years ago. And they wanted to figure out what's the lowest quality we could use and still be intelligible. And it turned out to be very low quality. It wasn't digital. It's analog, so I can't. It's not, you know, 4-bit or 6-bit, but it's about comparable to 4-bit sound. It's very low quality. You know, phone calls sound like this. But what the engineers figured out is, well, the human ear is pretty good at distinguishing what somebody's saying if they sound like this. So we're going to use that quality. And that all makes sense back then. But here we are nowadays with much, you know, basically unconstrained bandwidth, especially if you're on Wi-Fi. Calls could sound really good. They could sound at least as good as they do on Skype. Skype's a good example. You know, Skype, if you have a lot of bandwidth on both sides of the call, you sound like you're in the same room. Chris Marquardt, we just talked to him. He's in Germany. And we're talking in real time. It sounds like he's in the studio. Studio quality over Skype. He's got a good microphone. I have a good microphone. We both have lots of bandwidth, so it's ideal Skype conditions. But Skype doesn't have that artificial limitation. But I have to say, when you use Wi-Fi on a cell phone, in some cases, they still limit it to really that kind of low bandwidth sound because that's what people are used to. And it is a little disorienting. My daughter and I both have Wi-Fi calling on T-Mobile. We both use it at home. And when she calls me, she sounds so much better than on the phone. And at first, it's like, whoa, are you here? Are you in the room? And then I eventually go, oh, that's Wi-Fi calling. Lou, Los Angeles. Hello, Lou. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Hope you're having a happy.
I'm having a happy. I hope you are having a happy.
Well, only one thing is standing between me and eternal happiness, and that's getting Microsoft to leave me the heck alone. I've got three Acer Switch 10s. The two, they're great little machines. The two that are on Windows 8 and 8.1, no problem. The Windows 10 one wants me to update constantly, won't load an update because there isn't enough space, and it's just a constant struggle.
Oh, isn't that a pain? And there's no way to turn that off that I know of.
Oh, dear.
The reason, I understand Microsoft's point of view here. Updates are what protects you from bad guys in most cases. The updates, some of the updates are feature updates, but most of the time these days, that monthly update, the Patch Tuesday you get, is almost always fixing security vulnerabilities. And it's important not only for you to protect yourself, but if you have a vulnerable computer, it impacts the rest of us because it spreads bad stuff. It attacks other systems, even without your knowledge and certainly without your permission. So it's kind of a public health measure. I've heard it compared to public health, and I think it's kind of the case that it's your duty and responsibility as a computer user to keep your system free from infection, to keep it up to date. And that keeping it up to date is the number one best way to keep yourself safe and the internet safe. So Microsoft decided, and it's a very controversial decision, not to let people defer upgrades for more than a period of time. Now, depends on which version of Windows you have. Some versions of Windows will let you defer as long as a year. Most versions of Windows, almost certainly what you got on the Acer Switch, 30 days. So you're going to get it in 30 days, even if you defer it. Now, look in your settings. You can defer it. The sad thing is that Acer, it's not Microsoft's fault. Well, maybe it is a little bit. Sold you a device that can't be updated. And we're seeing that with really low storage devices, you know, 32 gigabytes of storage or less. There's just not enough room. And I think in the case like that, they shouldn't even be allowed to sell that. Because if Microsoft's going to demand updates, you ought to be able to do it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, so Verizon does offer high-quality Wi-Fi calling. That's good to know. Lisa used to be Wi-Fi, Verizon, but nobody recently has been Wi-Fi. I mean, Verizon. I'm getting punchy. The Tech Guy Podcast brought to you, as it has been for a long, long time, by the folks from LastPass. Well, they haven't. When I say brought to you by LastPass, I mean I log in every day with LastPass. We use LastPass Enterprise for the business. In fact, I'm such a believer in using LastPass that I give it. It's one of the benefits we offer as a company to employees. They get a free LastPass account. That's how important it is for your security. If you're right now trying to remember passwords or writing them down or letting the browser remember them, if you're using the same password on a bunch of different sites or variations, if your password consists of birth dates, dogs' names, children's names, stop the insanity. You need LastPass. There are just too many passwords to remember. And a good password is just not memorable. It's long, crazy, random stuff. Alphabetic, numeric, punctuation. LastPass makes managing your personal accounts and securing workplace credentials easy, effortless. All you have to do is remember one password. The last pass you'll ever have to remember, that unlocks your password vault. From then on, LastPass fills in your passwords whenever you need them. If you need a new password for a new account, it generates, stores strong, unique passwords, not just on your computer, on your browser, but on your mobile device. A different password for every site. It even has a security checkup, so it can make sure that sites that you've used or created passwords for before LastPass are safe too. You know, one-touch password reset for all of your vital accounts, that's great too. I love emergency access. That's a feature LastPass added that lets you designate somebody in case of an emergency. If you're, you know, if you die or you're incapacitated, your wife or your husband or your loved ones can take over your LastPass account. Let me tell you, I know this is something people don't like to talk about, but you know, I've heard so many stories of people who pass away. No one can get in their accounts. They've lost bank accounts, investment accounts are gone because no one knows how to get into them. Or you have to go through all the trouble to get them unlocked. LastPass just does this easily with a very secure system they call emergency access. Family sharing is great too, and I do that with my family because, you know, we have passwords for our electric bill or our cable bill. Lisa says, how do you log into the... I said, no problem. I'm just going to share that with you. It's in her LastPass vault. Sure, she uses it. Everybody I know, everybody in my family, everybody I work with, and here at work, we use LastPass Enterprise because it's the password management system for companies of every size. All the tools you need to secure your business, centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. Did you know 81% of all breaches are caused by bad passwords? Stop the insanity. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. And of course, it's secure, encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to protect man-in-the-middle attacks. There's LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Certainly, no doubt about it. It's number one here and has been for years. LastPass.com/twit. I started using it. Steve Gibson actually talked to Joe Zegers, the guy who created LastPass, verified everything works as expected. Now Steve Gibson uses it. You should be using it. LastPass.com/twit to find out which product is right for you. We thank LastPass for supporting the podcast and keeping the tech guy secure. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Get any good Easter eggs today? April Fool's Day and Easter for the first time in 62 years on the same day. So long before the internet, right? 1956 was the last time Easter and April Fool's were on the same day. So this is a red letter day, a once in a blue moon opportunity for the computer industry to really mess around with you. Am I wrong? It used to be. It seemed only a few years ago that there were April Fool's jokes everywhere. I think maybe it got tiresome because you'd read the news and you wouldn't know what to believe. And Google seemed to spend more energy on April Fool's jokes than their actual services. And I think there must have been at some point a few years ago a memo that went out that said, all right, knock it off. It's just another day. Google's April Fool's jokes have been fairly benign since. And also, I think few. There are a few, but not anywhere near, feels like, not anywhere near the number there have been in years past. And here's the good news. You can go and read the news, and you don't have to look at each article and go, is this true? It is April Fool's. Is this true? We talked about Where's Waldo and Google Maps. That's one. That's fun. If you haven't done that yet, go open your Google Maps app on your phone, and you'll see a little Waldo, and you can play the game for some time. The Google Cloud folks announced Google Cloud Hummus. Yeah, you could tell they're not putting the same amount of energy in this year. That was it. That's pretty much it. T-Mobile announced a shoe phone, a smart shoe phone in a Converse-style pink, or I guess that's magenta, isn't it? Sneaker. Called T-Mobile's Sidekicks. Now, see, it's a mistake to announce that because I think some people would want it. Gaming company Razer announced something they're called Project Venom 2, a nanobot-based upgrade that turns you into gaming hardware. See, I don't mind that because there's just, you know, you look at that and go, yeah, right. Pokemon Go, have you played that today? They're all 8-bit. Augmented reality from the years gone by. But I'm good. I'm not complaining. Ironically, there was one announcement this April Fool's that sounded like an April Fool's joke and wasn't. In fact, I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to mention it because it might be worth trying. A company called Cloudflare. I like a lot. Cloudflare is a company that kind of provides internet services for large companies. They're good. In fact, they've been a sponsor in the past. I think they're still a sponsor of some of our podcasts. Announced a new DNS service, 1111. I was sure this is an April Fool's joke. But Matthew Prince, their CEO, said, you may wonder why we're launching this on April Fool's Day. Well, we just thought 4-1s. On 4-1 made a lot of sense. 1.1.1.1 would replace your internet service provider's DNS. That's something that's set automatically in your computer or your router if you have a router. When you're looking up an address on the internet, you go to the domain name server or DNS server and say, hey, I want to go to yahoo.com. What number is that? And it's like a phone book, really. Typically, you'll use your internet service providers. That's kind of the default. But 1.1.1.1 is a replacement that you could actually put in. Almost all routers, all computers have a place where you could substitute the default DNS phone book with your own. And the idea is 1.1.1.1 is privacy forward. It would keep your internet service provider from capturing the information it gets from you using their phone book. That's nice. It's possible Cloudflare could add at some point protection from malware or even advertising. DNS really is a powerful tool. If an advertising server can't look up its address, it can't serve you ads. I don't think they're doing that yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to see something like that. So 1.1.1.1 is, I'm pretty sure, as much as it looks like an April Fool's joke, I'm pretty sure it's not. And it uses something that is very good and modern called DNS over HTTPS. It encrypts the data about your web browsing as it goes online. Another nice privacy feature. So they've really focused on privacy when you use 1.1.1.1. And potentially, if it's a good server and it's working well, it could speed you up as well. DNS servers from your internet service provider sometimes are not the best. Sometimes they're a little slow. Although I am hearing from some people in the chat room that today 1.1.1.1 is iffy. I guess a lot of people saw the story and are trying it out. The good news is 1.1.1.1 comes from Cloudflare, whose business is remediating what they call denial of service attacks. They have a lot of bandwidth and servers all over the world. So if anybody could handle an onslaught of traffic, it would be Cloudflare. Have you seen any great Easter eggs yourself this year? 8888 Ask Leo. Or put them up on the website, techguylabs.com. Alan's on the line from Charlton, Massachusetts. Hello, Alan.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have never been on the show, but I did see you in Petaluma.
Oh, nice to talk to you then.
Yeah. My problem is I'm working with digital photos, and I've got a new PC. I'm trying to copy a lot of photos from one to another. I'm using a portable drive I stuck on my main PC. So I got a HP Spectre 16 gig of RAM, 500 gig of SSD on it. Pretty nice performance. But I'm trying to put photos in there. And the problem is, a lot of these photos I have raw and I have regular. I actually have Lightroom on the other PC, and I haven't put it on the new one yet. So when I'm putting them on there, it's making copies. It's automatically doing too many things I don't want. I'm an old school kind of guy, and
yeah,
love to be able to copy a file and have it go where I want and not be 50 places.
Just put it in one spot. I don't blame you. Yeah, yeah. Especially with photos, because especially if you're editing them with Photoshop or as you are Lightroom, then you can have multiple copies of the same photo, which is really annoying.
Exactly. And I have many, many of them. And also, because I was helping other people out, I have tons of their photos, which is a problem, right? So I have like redundant of their own. I don't recognize the photos, maybe some of their family photos.
Yeah, this happens. For a while, I was using a desktop wallpaper, downloading it from, I think it was 500px. A website using an automated downloader, and it polluted my entire photo stream with pictures much better than mine. And it was very frustrating because I'm going through my photo stream. All of a sudden, these gorgeous landscape photos, I'm going, oh, these are more wallpapers from 500px. I gotta figure out a way to get rid of them. So there's a couple of solutions that work quite well. Of course, there are file deduplicators. I'm always reluctant to use those because you don't want to accidentally delete originals. But in most cases, a good file deduplicator will find, duplicates and be careful about only deleting real duplicates as opposed to things that look alike. And you can often set parameters to determine that. We'll put a list of deduplicators. We've done this before in our show notes. I won't go through that whole list again. I use Google Photos. You have Lightroom. You might want to use Adobe's cloud services. You have Microsoft Windows. You might want to use OneDrive. Those are great ways to back up as well. They don't have deduplication services, but I think it's, in some ways, a better thing to have copies on the cloud. In fact, you can, because many of these services are free, Amazon Prime has free unlimited backup. Google Photos has free unlimited backup. If you're paying for Adobe's Creative Cloud, you get a terabyte of backup, which for most people is sufficient to cover a decade worth of photos. All of these services are inexpensive or free, and that means you can back up everything in multiple places, and that's very nice too. So for deduplication, yeah, you're probably going to run a program to do that. And then I guess my suggestion would be to pick a couple of different cloud services and use those for backup. Keep one copy of originals locally, one copy backed up you know, offsite, and let the services back it up too. And you're never going to lose a photo. And because the storage is virtually unlimited in most of these cases, a few duplicates aren't going to kill you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this. A little green onions for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Put a little green onion in your lock, because that's good. John on the line from Anchorage, Alaska. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, we have a nice sunny day. You might hit 40 today, so it's looking good.
Oh man. And I was thinking how cold it is here in California because it was in the 50s. I'm thinking, I'm so cold.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. I know our daughter was down in Disneyland, and it was bad for them also.
Yeah.
My problem is I had a Wi-Fi problem.
Okay.
We were on a vacation for 2 weeks,
yeah.
And about halfway through, I was getting from my security system over the internet alarm. It was high winds,
oy,
and blowing snow. And
oh.
I got about a 40 of these warnings. Now I finally turned it off and went to bed. Next morning, I turned it on to check it out, and nothing. I couldn't log in. And I came up thinking that, well, the wind, high winds, 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, knocked out my Wi-Fi.
Something blew over.
Modem.
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, it knocked it out for maybe 2 or 3 seconds. Not enough to reboot. Well, I'm wondering what's going on. I call a neighbor. I said, I can't log in. Can you go up the back of my house, turn my electricity off for a minute so my modem will reboot, which took care of the problem.
Wow, very clever.
Everything booted. It booted back up my phone because I use Wi-Fi, you know, phone. I have a security system and a temp app, because when we're gone in the winter, I like to be able to monitor my temperature upstairs and downstairs. So all of that wasn't working, and I was sort of concerned.
Yeah, you're really dependent on this, especially when you're not there, and it's the potential, right, of pipes freezing and all of that.
Yeah, so I just wonder if there's, what could I do in the future if, you know, it goes out and I can't, you know, what keep it from coming back on, because it was only off. I don't know what the time frame is for rebooting. I think it's about a minute, Jeff.
Yeah, but you don't want to always have to call your neighbors, do you?
Yeah. So then I came up, well, I put one of these light timers on, have it on all day except for like 15 minutes in the middle of the night. Every day, turn it on and off if I'm on a trip.
So there are, of course, remote ways to switch power off or on, but all of them that I know of use the internet to do it.
That's right. Use the internet.
If you can't get to it, rebooting the power, you have to have some other way to reach the power,
yes,
system. I imagine there could be telephone connected devices. What you might want to do, I think this might be a better solution for you. In fact, I would highly recommend it if power is, yeah, an issue, is an uninterruptible power supply. You can get whole house versions, by the way. And if,
mm-hmm,
you ask your electrician, it's not as expensive as it might sound, because it's really all just at one spot, the junction,
yeah,
box where the power comes in. And an electrician could put that in. There's a battery pack. That'll keep – you can get them as big as, you know, a day's worth of power. That's going to be more expensive, though, than getting a standalone UPS that you just plug your Wi-Fi router into.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of that is you get
– I have one of those old ones that I've had for years for my computer, but I never used it. The battery went bad.
It'll go bad every year or so. You'll have to replace the battery on these, because they're always in use. On a good one, they're always cycling. So, but the advantage of this is twofold. Not only do you have this backup on the Wi-Fi, so even if the power glitches because of a windstorm or whatever,
mm-hmm,
the Wi-Fi will keep working. It also protects the Wi-Fi router and any other electronics attached to it, because most, mm-hmm, most of these good ones, and I would recommend getting one that does what we call power conditioning, will, your power will run through the UPS. So some UPSs, mm-hmm, are failover. The power goes out. There's a brief moment of time when the device gets no power, and then the UPS kicks in. That is not as desirable, although it is less expensive. Mm-hmm. What you really want is one that's running the power through the battery all the time. So if the power goes out, it doesn't matter. Continuous power supply. That will also smooth out power spikes, brownouts, and that really is a good idea for sensitive electronic equipment. Actually, low power can sometimes be worse than a power surge.
So with it doing it, then there would be no interruption to my motor.
There'd be no interruption. Right. You do have to remember that, you know, you're only going to have a certain amount of power capacity. That's why a whole house solution will, of course, have big batteries because you're powering a lot of stuff, including your refrigerator. But if you're just going to power a Wi-Fi router, that sips at power. It doesn't use very much power at all. And you could easily get a, you know, 5, 6, 24-hour UPS that would just power that small device fairly affordably. Number of companies make these. Yeah, number of companies make these. I've used APCC for a long time. Triplight, Cyber Power is one that people are really recommending. The words to look for, sine wave UPS, that cleans up the power, makes it a clean sine wave, and will also condition it and keep your gear safe. And that'll get you through the there may be, I wouldn't be surprised, you can ask your electrician if there is some sort of dial-up reboot system that you call in. But, of course, all the ones I know of are IP-based. They go over the internet. If the internet's what's going out, rebooting your house without it isn't going to be possible. So look at a good cyber power, smart UPS, protect the gear and keep it running. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I think there's probably phone-based... Let me see. Smartphone-based telephone-based power strip. You could Yeah, here you go. Remote RDU. Belkin makes them. Power switch controlled by the telephone. Actually, this is from... I don't know who this is from. Smart power switch designed to control AC outlets through a telephone keypad. The only remote power reboot solution in the market when no internet network connection is available. So there you go. And it's not expensive. It's $100. So it has to have a password, of course. So you call into it. Then you enter the password. And you can use two power. So this would be another way to do it. I'll put a link to this. It's from All About Adapters, the remote PDU power switch. Let me put a link in the chat room. I almost prefer to put, you know, you have the UPS. But on the other hand, having both of them might be a great, you know, kind of double solution. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. We're doing the 80s thing. Saw Ready Player One yesterday. It's all about 80s nostalgia. A lot of fun. And virtual reality and sci-fi and games and fun show. Really enjoyed it. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. And we are going to keep taking calls after the show today. I should let you know I'm recording ahead. For future episodes, if you can't get through or you want to get through and you're around in about half an hour, this would be a good time to call. 8888-ASK-LEO. We'll keep taking calls for another 45 minutes after the show ends. David Hollywood, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, David.
Okay, Leo.
What can I do for you today?
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Yes. I'm a disgruntled... Alienware 17 R7 laptop owner. I bought this last year and I used it for about 6 months. And after that, I was run down by a crazy driver in Hollywood
almost
killed me. And so for the last 5 months, I have been using the laptop. And so I started using it like 2 months ago. And a little bit, because I couldn't see well. And then the computer started giving me problems and more problems. The motherboard had to be replaced 3 times, and still batteries. And then
was it in the accident, or that's unrelated?
It's not related. It's just
was it in the accident, though? Was it in the accident?
It was not.
Okay.
It was at home.
And, got it. You just stopped using it for a while. I'm glad you're feeling better, by the way. That's good.
Well, yeah, I'm in a wheelchair, so
I'm so sorry.
I'm looking forward to walking on my legs again.
I bet you are.
Anyway, the seniors technicians came and checked it out, and it's still not working. I'm looking forward to have it replaced. But one of the SD cards, the first one, I had a bunch of programs there, and the computer was not responding and didn't wipe out the, because they tried to bring it to factory status, but it wasn't able to. So I held on to the card, and I only have 10 days left to wipe it out. But I don't know a device that will fit into the SSD card, 1 terabyte, and it's PCIe generation 3x4.
So it's is it in the computer? Is it inside the computer? Or is it an external card?
It was.
Okay, so you want to format the SSD that's in the computer before you send it back to Acer, and I certainly hope they give you a replacement, because that's terrible. Yeah, it should be working, especially it's still under warranty. Good news. The problem is it's very hard to erase an SSD 100%. You probably can get most of what's on there, but the way SSDs work, you can't guarantee that every bit of data is gone. Most people, that's not going to matter. Just what I would recommend doing is just reinstalling Windows on there and just, you know, erase the drive if you need to beforehand, and that would probably be good enough. If you want to work a little harder, there's a program called DBAN, Derek's Boot and Nuke, that will do the best job possible of erasing it. It's one of those programs that overwrites the data and then, you know, erases it again and overwrites it again. But the problem with SSDs is that they don't work the same way as spinning drives, and there's often some leakage of data on an SSD. This would mean somebody really wanted to get you, and you would have to have the bad luck of putting something on the drive that didn't get erased that really was worth something. I wouldn't worry about it. Acer's not going to do anything with that. For future reference, everybody should understand this. SSDs, whether it's your phone, whether it's your laptop, solid-state disk drives, leak information. It's because of what's called wear leveling on the drive. Data is written in a variety of places, not always in the places the drive expects data to be. You can erase the known file system, but other stuff will always be there. Wear leveling prohibits anything like DBAN from getting to every little corner of it. It doesn't leak all of the stuff. Most of the stuff is erased. It's just bad luck if your password file is somewhere where it didn't get erased. Every time I use an SSD, every time you use an SSD, every time you get a new phone, the solution for this is before you start using it, encrypt it. Turn on encryption. If you have a file system, operating system that supports encrypted file systems, whether it's BitLocker on Windows, FileVault on Macintosh, just turn it on. The first thing you do, it's part of your setup. On your phone, most phones are encrypted now. iPhones are all encrypted, so you don't have to worry. Samsung phones, I think they encrypt the internal by default. They do not encrypt the SD card, so turn that on. And the reason is, even though it won't be all erased, little crumbs of information will be left behind. They're worthless without the password. So as soon as you reset the machine, start over, it's gobbledygook. It's still there, but it's encrypted gobbledygook. So that's really important nowadays. This is a very different advice from previous days. On spinning drives, you could use something like Darren's Boot and Nuke to guarantee that the drive was completely erased. It's not true on SSDs anymore. So you really should encrypt right away. That way, nothing that you put on that drive will be there unencrypted. It's useless without the key. And Missing is saying in the chat room something wrong. So I want to say again, even if you boot from an external drive and you run DBAN on an SSD internally, that will not erase everything. The drive is fighting you. This is the problem. The SSD is fighting you. It's using something called wear leveling. The whole idea in an SSD of wear leveling is that no one cell gets written to too many times because they wear out. And so wear leveling prevents a erasing program from erasing everything. It won't be able to get to everything. That's just the nature of SSDs, I'm sorry to say. I'm sorry about your accident. I hope you're feeling better soon. And I do hope Acer takes good care of you. You deserve to have a computer that works, that's for sure. John in West Palm Beach, Florida. Leo Laporte. Was that John? That was John. Was it? No. Hi, John.
Hello.
You have a similar problem.
Well, kind of, sort of.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Before I get to that, I was just watching last week. Well, I want to say I'm not a long-term listener, but I discovered you guys like a couple months ago, and I've been binge-watching like crazy all your previous episodes.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was just watching last week's podcast, and someone was wanting to upgrade from 7 to 10, and of course the disability thing disappeared where they had the free upgrade.
Yeah.
And I came across an article on Ars Technica, or one of those, that said that if you install Windows 10, you can still use the Windows 7 or 8 key to validate it. And as of the time of the article, they said it still worked.
So, well, that's good news. In other words, Microsoft hadn't really disabled it. They just said they disabled it.
Exactly.
That's really good news. You know, why not keep that going forever, Microsoft? I think that's a good thing.
I don't know if it still works, but that was an article I came across. Anyway, my problem is, a couple of years ago, I bought my first SSD from Intel, came with a disk, and of course, I thought, you know, the disk must have something good on it, so I stuck it in and installed it, and it installed a RAID program on the BIOS of my computer, which I don't need, don't want, and there's no way of removing it. I've gone into my BIOS, I've reflashed my BIOS, I've been all over the internet looking for an answer, and I can't find any way of taking
it. It's not using it, is it? It's just there.
It's just there, right?
No, just ignore it. Almost, this is software RAID, almost all BIOSes, or now we call them firmware, because there's no such thing as BIOS anymore, it's EFI, but almost all firmware comes with the capability of doing RAID. Don't worry about it. It's not taking up any room that you need. It's not there. It's not being used. I don't know of any way to get rid of it. I don't know why you'd want to. That's just a feature in the firmware that you're not using. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. More calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Steve, Redondo Beach, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome.
It was interesting how you were talking about April Fool's jokes with Pokemon Go. There's a lot of players out there that are upset that they went to the 8-byte.
Oh, really? They don't like it? Mix. It'll go back, I'm sure, tomorrow. It'll go back to normal.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of clever. You know, I think that's one reason we're not seeing as many April Fool's jokes. I think it really annoys people.
The chat on Facebook and the groups that I'm in, they just don't like it.
Yeah. Stop messing with Pokemon Go. I'm trying to play here. That's pretty funny.
So anyways, the question I have is, I have a RCA Cambio. It's a 2-in-1.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to set it up for a second device now, but I forgot the Windows password.
Oh, no. What version of Windows are you on?
Windows 10.
Okay. So in older versions of Windows, forgetting your password didn't make too much of a difference because it really didn't pay any attention to the password. The worst case scenario was Windows 95, where it would just let you in without a password. That was definitely a security issue. So they've made it a little bit harder each successive versions of Windows to get your password back. Ideally, you know, your password should not be recoverable. It is possible, and I don't know if you did this, to make a Windows password reset disk. But you have to do it before you lose your password. You don't happen to have that. In fact, I think if you did, you wouldn't be calling, would you?
No. I didn't do that.
That's a little lesson for everybody with Windows 10 right now. You might want to, if before you forget your password, you might want to make a password reset disk. So Okay. We're going to go to Plan B, which, is, by the way, that's the only way to do it that Microsoft recommends. That's their official method. Mm-hmm. Well, you made a password recovery disk, didn't you? Well, no, of course I didn't. I wasn't planning on forgetting my password. Did you use your Microsoft account to log in?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that's easier. That's good news. So you've forgotten your Microsoft account password, in other words.
It's just when I turn it on, it asked for the password, and then I typed in what I thought it was, and then that wasn't it.
Well, if you use, and this, yeah, if this is, by the way, always my recommendation, use your Windows, Microsoft Windows account, not your, so in the old, again, this goes back to the old days, you know, it wasn't tied to anything, it was just a password you made up when you set up the computer. Nowadays, when you sign up Windows 10, the default is, what's your Microsoft account? And it'll log you in that way. If that's how you did it, you're golden. You just go to another computer and reset your password. Go to your Microsoft account on the browser and say, I forgot my password. And it's a normal password forgot you system. And by the way, that works really well.
Okay.
So yeah, do you remember that? I mean, it's actually hard on Windows 10 not to use your Microsoft password. You have to kind of click around a little bit to use your own password. So did you do that, or do you remember?
No, I know my Microsoft account password.
It's not the one you use to log into Windows?
No. Oh. It was totally different. It was something that was supposed to be real easy to remember, and
okay.
I hadn't used this laptop in a while. So.
So that's, again, I'm going to just say for the rest of you listening, use your Microsoft account password, because you can always make, after you create that account, you can always make a PIN, you can use a picture, there's all sorts of other ways to log in. You can have a 5-digit PIN if you want, or a 3-digit PIN. Maybe you have to have 4, but you can make a short, easy-to-remember PIN. Use that to log in day in, day out. But if you ever forget that PIN, you can use your Microsoft account to get back in. If you only use a local account for Windows 10, then this gets more complicated. So I'm going to take your word for it that you didn't use your Microsoft account. It's kind of hard. You have to actually work at it to not use a Microsoft account login. I take it you didn't create a PIN or anything like that either.
No. When I first set it up, it just said, what do you want to call the computer? And what do you want the password to be?
Oh, really? Were you not online? Or maybe it wasn't Windows 10 when you set it up.
No, it was a Windows 10.
Huh.
That's the way it was bought. And then I tried even doing the factory reset to wipe everything and go back to the day we bought it. I was able to do it only the one time. And now we can't get back into even doing a factory reset.
That's weird. Are you sure it's not a hard drive password or something like that? It's not.
No, it's
the Windows login password. Windows. You should be able to recover.
Windows login.
Okay. Well, Microsoft does make something called the Microsoft Diagnostics and Recovery Tool Set. It's really designed for a business where, you know, an employee walked out the door and you don't know the employee's password, but you want to wipe the computer and use it again. MS Dart. You can download it from Microsoft. You're going to make a Dart recovery USB key or CD if you have a CD drive. Most people don't. And in that, there is a what they call the locksmith wizard, which does exactly what you want to do. You can reset the Windows 10 password. You don't need to go to any pirate program. Microsoft has a program to do that. There are, not pirates, the wrong word, third-party Windows password unlocking tools. There's PC Unlocker. That will also work. I'll tell you what, I will put a link in the show notes to the 6 ways to reset a forgotten Windows 10 password. I'll put that in the show notes right now at techguylabs.com, and you can work your way down through the list. It really starts with the best way to do it and goes down to the worst way to do it. MS Dart is, I didn't know about MS Dart till I read this article, though. That's probably a good way to do it. Let me look. Microsoft says apparently if you forgot your Windows account password, you can't do a recovery. You have to reset the PC. So if you're willing to lose whatever's on that computer, you can just completely start over by doing a reset this PC. Go to the boot options, troubleshoot, reset this PC. And that's to protect you. That's to protect your data. It'll erase the whole hard drive. If you don't mind that, that's also an option. So let's make it 7 ways. 7 ways to get your hard drive back. We are done, at least for the moment. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to keep the calls going. I'm recording ahead for future shows. So if you're on the line, hang on the line. And if you're not on the line, 8888, ask Leo. And we will be taking more calls for another about 45 minutes. Thanks to Michael Cozio for spinning the 80s discs today, our musical director. Thanks to Kim Schaffer for answering the phones. Most of all, thanks to you for joining me. I appreciate it. And I'll see you next time. Have a great geek week. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.